Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Robots of Red Tape. As always, I'm your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have my friend Josh Wood with me here today. Josh, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Doing well.
Awesome, man. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on. I know you're very, very busy now, as you know, recently into retirement. But man, for everybody that, you know, obviously today we're talking about AI and legal tech. For everybody that doesn't have the opportunity to know you yet, man, you tell folks a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here.
Sure. At least in the legal sphere, I started as a contractor many years ago, about almost 30 years ago, working for the Department of Justice. I was a contractor for 8 years, and during that time, I became the IT person for that case. I didn't have a whole lot of experience with IT before then, but they needed help, and so I just started reading books. I had like a $2,000 a year book budget, and I would just voraciously read books, and I wound up doing networking, programming, application development, basically full stack development for this case. And I had a boss who was a little crazy and would come in and just say, "Hey, I was talking to the attorneys today. Wouldn't it be great if we could do this?" I told them we'd have it for them tomorrow. So I wind up writing code till 2 o'clock in the morning, going to sleep, and sending it to my staff. I was picked up by the government as an IT specialist, and did some security work under that, and then became the IT branch chief for the Office of Litigation Support in the civil division of the Department of Justice. I did that for about 5 years, and then became the director for the Office of Litigation Support. So I moved out of IT and into management. But I really s stayed very close to the IT side of things. And did that for 13 years.
It's amazing, man.
Yeah.
Amazing. And so can you for folks that don't understand, can you tell people some of the cases that you supported, cases that you worked on, some of the larger ones that we may have heard about that hit the news?
Sure. So, like, if you go back in time, Hurricane Katrina. There were a number of claims against the Army Corps of Engineers. That was a huge case at that time. So I worked on that. And then I helped with the 2010 flash crash on the stock market, investigating that. The Deepwater Horizon BP oil spill. More recently, the residential backed mortgage securities. So that was the housing crisis back in 2000. And then I've done a bunch of healthcare fraud cases with most of the major insurance companies.
Absolutely, man. So you've helped the government prosecute some of the largest and most complex cases over the last 20 years, 25 years.
Yeah, each one of those cases in order was the largest case ever litigated by the Department of Justice, and by extension, probably in the entire United States.
That's incredible, man. That's incredible. And so, as somebody that's been in, around the space a little bit but doesn't know it well, when you look at these massive, massive cases, you talk about like the BP oil spill case, Katrina, cases around Katrina, mortgage-backed securities cases. What goes into prosecuting that from a technical perspective?
Well, the first thing you have to do is wrap your head around what data you have, right? And what you need, right? So the litigators come in and they will say, "We think the case is about this." And so we go into a discovery phase and we say, "Okay, send me all of your documents that meet these criteria, whether it's date range, keyword search, individual mailboxes." And this is true for defensive as well, because I did a lot of defensive cases, but it's with a client agency. They'll usually come back saying, "Hey, we have some limitations. Let's work on the keyword terms, this and that and the other." That negotiation goes on, and then you start receiving documents. If it's a prosecution, generally the first documents you get are tr worthless, right? The really important stuff they hold on to till the end,
Right.
because they want to make sure that they treat it properly, presumably. But once you've got your corpus of documents, you really need to know what you have. there's a number of different technological ways. Now, mind you, we're talking like an average case these days that we were prosecuting was at least 1 million documents. So back in the old days, we would have 300 contract lawyers reading through all of the documents. But these days, we do things like concept clustering. We use something called TAR, which is technology assisted review. We can even use that's generally used for productions from us, but you can also use it as an investigative tool. So you can go through and say, I want to find all the hot documents, and you just start tagging documents and training the model, and the model will go find you more hot documents. And then you also have to look at the file types that you have. I mean, a lot of what we deal with is text, but there's a lot of other data out there. And so one of the things I was especially proud of working at Department of Justice was I built the ATOM Lab, which is an advanced data analytics and modeling lab, which was a team of contractors that basically worked for all of the litigating components, not just the civil division. And they would tackle data science issues. So if you had 10,000 Excel spreadsheets that you needed linked up and analyzed, they could go do that.
That's incredible. Yeah, absolutely. You said the average case was like a million, is a million documents now or so.
Yeah.
What about the large ones? Like, you talk about the BP oil spill case with the like how many doc like how large was that
I
discovery?
think that was 10 million documents, roughly. But you have to understand that that case, when it occurred, all of NOAA, every field office in NOAA was redirected to deal with that case. And including ones in Anchorage, Alaska. And so when it came time to collect the documents, we had people in the field taking photos with their cameras. And we had literally a war room down in Louisiana where people were dealing with a crisis where if they wrote a word on any piece of paper that was printed out, there was a box in the middle of the room. They just throw the paper in there for preservation purposes. When we collected, we actually had to go to the Army Corps of Engineers and NOAA. NOAA took care of their own collection, but the Army Corps of Engineers, we worked with them to set up a tool that would go out to their field offices and search for the documents that we're looking for, and then slowly feed them back to headquarters. And so we had terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of documents coming in.
How do you manage like the logistics around organizing them all, categorizing them all, making sure that you know where at, like, because you have to have, there's the chain of custody associated with all of it, right? Because if you know if one document, if you don't know exactly where it is the entire time, it will no longer be relevant. Is that correct?
In a criminal case, absolutely. In a civil case, maybe not so much. Generally, you want to have like a clear line of how you collected it and everything like that. And you should be able to go to the court and say, yes, this document came from this location. But like, I'll use the paper example, right? If that box, that container of paper documents that had handwriting on it, you can't attribute that back to an individual person. But you can say it came from that box. So it has to be attributable to, at least to that level. So we use in all of our databases, we use a field called custodian or custodians, plural. And that really sort of like links that document back to that person or place, like a shared network drive, for example. So that's really how we attribute it, but it's an extra piece of metadata that's associated with the documents.
Absolutely. That's incredible, man. And so going through at you're collecting 10 million documents, managing them all and getting making and then you're helping to process them all and helping get the attorneys what they need to pro what they think they need to prosecute the case.
Yeah, so we take the raw documents, we extract out all of the metadata and the text, generally generate TIFF images, which are static single page images. The metadata is then loaded into a database with the text, so all of that becomes searchable. And then it's linked to the individual pages so that you can review the actual documents themselves. From there, it's really just sort of wrapping your head around what's responsive and what's not responsive in the piece. If they, again, concept searching, keyword searching, there's a lot of just sort of like trying to cut through the noise of all of that data. And we've been generally successful around doing that. I spent many years going to legal tech, and just telling the industry, like, you are not using the best tools. You can do better. But we're starting to see some of that, some of what I envisioned out there in the space to be available.
Absolutely. With the tech where it is, what are the things that you had envisioned that that you're starting to see come to reality?
Well, so when I first started, there was, so back in 2007, 2007, 2008, we had this concept of TAR come up, and there were a couple of companies that were promoting it. And it, TAR is Technology Assisted Review, which eventually evolved into CAL, which is Computer Aided Learning. And I was a big proponent of it. I thought it was great. There were a bunch of people in DOJ who were like, it's untested, we can't do this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, trust me, I don't want to have 300 attorneys looking at my stuff.
Absolutely. Because
But at
humans are
that
fallible
time,
or more fallible than a trained model. Is that correct?
yeah, they are. There's a Berkeley study going back to 2000, sorry, 1984, I think it was, where they researched BART. It was a legal case against BART, which is the Bay Area Rapid Transit. And they stuck a bunch of lawyers to review the material. And then they put it against an, not a chatbot back then, but like an assisted type of review. And it turns out the more people you put into a legal review process, the more interpretations of what is responsive and what is not responsive occur. And so you get wildly erring differences between the two. Whereas the assisted project came out with much more statistically accurate responses.
Sorry, but you were saying something. I cut you off. I apologize.
No, it's okay. I forgot what I was talking about.
You were talking about what you had envisioned
Oh, right. Yeah.
and technology assisted review, and how it's much better than having 300 attorneys sitting in a room. I would assume it's less expensive than having 300 attorneys sitting in a room, but I don't know that for sure.
It is. It is. So at that time, I was very big on, concept clustering, threading, email threading, things like that were just sort of, they weren't really heavily utilized. And I was like, look, there's ways to take this data and slice it and dice it and get a faster, smoother work product out at the other end. And the industry was really like, oh, we're doing keyword searching. And I'm like, no, you got to go way further than
Yeah,
that.
absolutely. 100%. And how you know and you know, as you think about some of these specific large complex cases, you know, what did you learn from, well, let's talk about the BP cases. That one's fascinating to me. Obviously, I think it's one of the largest oil spills in the world, in world history. You know, as you look at that, obviously the scale of data, but what did you learn about, you know, the complexity around prosecuting these massive, especially environmental cases?
That was an interesting one. So I was stuck in charge of the on the technical side, not the legal side, of the collections from NOAA and Army Corps of Engineers. And neither one of those organizations, even though they have a legal team, but they'd never dealt with collections. And this was a common theme throughout my career. But this one was of such a scale, and there were so many individuals involved that it was really, really difficult. I mean, like literally, we had people wandering along the wetlands in Louisiana and along the coast, taking photos with their phones, like as I mentioned, but we had to go collect all of those. And you know, thousands of people were doing this. And you think that it's going to be relatively straightforward. You say, okay, send me all your emails, send me all your phone collections and this and that and the other. But you one of the things that you have to do when you do litigation support and even litigation is you have to learn to pivot. There were a number of times where we ran into like, this isn't possible, right? And so we go, okay, if that's not possible, how do we get that information in another form or from another place? And we did a lot of that for the BP stuff.
Or any notable pivots you had to make that you could tell me about, or are they is that are you not allowed to talk about the specifics?
I'm not sure I really want to get into the specifics.
Okay.
Just because even though that case has been litigated, it's still, there's still some, I don't want to like cause any problems for the government or for
Totally
BP.
understand. No, listen, I'm just curious, man. I'm gonna ask the question. Because I can imagine that when you have that many people collecting that much data, right, where you're going out, you're taking pictures to see where the oil is actually hitting. I would assume there's also satellite images of seeing the oil and where it's moving
We
around.
had everything. We had tidal maps. We had all of the NOAA information about the Gulf Coast, weather information. There was a lot of data there, and there's a lot of stuff that at DOJ we just didn't have the capability of viewing. Some of these models were ArcGIS models. At that time, we didn't have an ArcGIS capability. And so we were just like, yeah, opposing counsel, here you go. And NOAA, we would have to go back to NOAA and basically say, like, look, hey, we can't run this. What is
Absolutely. And then you also didn't you also have to collect a whole bunch of data from BP and from Deepwater Point and all these other folks as well, to get kind of see what was going on internally, and understand like what had happened and kind of how it all transpired.
Yeah, so that was our part of the discovery process. So we asked them for any material regarding the explosion, safety measures, what were the conditions before the explosion, things along around those lines. The amount of data that we received from them was important, but in terms of volume, it was a lot less than what the Department of Justice collected from the client agencies, which isn't abnormal. So, like, if you sue the federal government, generally you are only going to need to produce a relatively small amount of material, whereas the federal government is going to have to go through a lot of material.
Absolutely, I'm sure.
But because all of our stuff was about the response and the inspections leading up to that.
No, man, it's fascinating. And I mean, were you they were you know are they were they giving you like, thousands and thousands, or have you been in the case where you've been given like thousands and thousands and thousands of boxes of printed emails instead of like digital files and having to sit and sort through all those? And or this or that then you just scan them and take them and turn them into the images.
So generally speaking, we don't receive printed emails for the most part. If it's electronic, we'll receive it in some sort of equivalent electronic format. There's under the quote unquote new rules of e-discovery, which 2007, I want to say it came out. There's a rule basically that says that if something's in in an electronic format, you can give it in an equivalent format, but you have to make sure that the metadata isn't removed, right? It's the metadata is included if it's relevant to the case. So like I could take an email and convert it to a PDF because it's going to embed a whole bunch of metadata from that email into the PDF and produce it that way, but I couldn't print it out because I'm just storing the metadata for that file.
Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense. Now, what were, what were some of the logistics challenges associated with managing all of that data for the BP case?
There were a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So that case was litigated by both the Environmental Natural Resources Division as well as the Civil Division. And so I had multiple bosses, sort of. I mean, I didn't really, but I did.
Absolutely.
I worked very closely with a woman named Sarah Himmelhawk in ENRD, who I had known for decades at that point. But I also had civil litigators reaching out to me to try and, prioritize things. So managing priorities, expectations, things like that were all fun challenges.
I'm sure. I'm sure. And I'm sure with, I know when you have too many cooks in the kitchen, things get more complicated. It gets much more difficult. And the prior you have to leverage like managing people's priorities. And then at the same time making sure you're not, blowing it also, right? And making sure that everybody has what they need.
But we did. I think the most important thing for that case was that we had funding. There's a fund called the 3% fund, which is basically for affirmative civil cases. If there's a judgment in favor of the government's position, they can take 3% of that earnings, the judgment, and put it towards other affirmative litigation cases. And we had a fairly large amount of money. And so we were sufficiently funded, but it took, I don't know, 4 or 5 months to get up to speed with the tech stack to be able to handle that.
Absolutely. How long did it take to prosecute that case?
Oh, I forget when it settled. It was fast and furious for about a year and a half. Collecting all the documents, processing all the documents, getting them organized. Meanwhile, legal filings were going back and forth, and probably within 6 months. And then I think it was like another year or so. I believe that case actually wound up settling. I don't think there was a ruling on the from the courts other than just, yeah, you guys can settle. But
And is that like a standard timeline for some of these larger cases, or is that
some of
pretty?
them go. Some of them go on longer. So on the affirmative side, there's a statute of limitations for investigations. Depending on, and I think the statute varies depending on what type of case it is. Just as an example, some of our investigations have a statute of limitations of 5 years. So we will be doing, having discussions with that entity for maybe year one or year saying, hey, we think we have a case, we're going to enter filing, we're going to do discovery, and then we'll go back and forth. Basically, it's not really an indictment, it's more of an investigation. So it's this it's called a CID, which is just a legal request for documents. If we find something damaging in there, we will file in court, at which point the statute of limitations, I think, is thrown out the window. So those cases, depending on how complex it is, can be anywhere from we'll file in like 8 months to 4 years. But then the case itself can, if it goes into what's called a rocket docket, which is expedited court, That'll last usually about a year, maybe less. And then if it's a longer, larger case and more complex, it could go on for years.
I can imagine. I can imagine. What was the most surprising piece of data or evidence you found in like in this collections process across the US?
I'll give you my favorite one and one that I've used in a lot of trainings. I was working on a case, and this attorney found a document. He's like, "This is a great document." And it was an investigation. And I went back and looked in the database, and it said, what was it? It was CYA was the name of the folder. Bless you. CYA was the name of the folder. And we opened it up, and inside there was everything that we had thought they were doing and found the documents for
Nice. Literally, they had a whole folder with everything you needed in it.
This one guy had it. He was covering himself. He was like, "This is what's going on. Okay, I'm just going to keep looking at it."
Absolutely. That's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. What's one of the, like, from a technology perspective, what are some of the largest bottlenecks through these massive cases?
The largest bottleneck is really processing. So the process of extracting the text out and the metadata isn't really that big, but if you're rendering images from those files, that's about two-thirds of the processing time.
Really?
And so it can get very time-consuming to process materials. So we would have I would have conversations with opposing counsel where they're like, "Well, we'll just give you the native files." I'm like, "I don't want the native files."
Is that like a compute issue, or why does it why does it take so long to render them?
So I don't know if you know anything about TIFF files, but
No,
so they
I know nothing. I'd love an explanation though.
okay. TIFF files were originally created for fax machines.
Nice.
So it's 1970s technology. The compute for it is very high. The memory is not so bad if the file is not that big. But the compute process is extremely difficult. I tried a number of years ago to run that through a GPU to see if I could throw 1,000 cores at it. But the problem is that the GPUs aren't, the chipsets really aren't designed for that kind of image generation. So I had some discussions with some chip manufacturers about that, but it never really led to anything. So.
Why are we using a file type that was created for the fax machine as opposed to I don't know anything else?
Oh. We can use PDFs with the images as well, but it's really sort of a legacy thing. First of all, you want it when you have documents, you do want to have some attestation that says this page came from this document, right? So use Bates numbers generally for that. But you if you're going to generate an image, you want it to be unalterable, right? Not to say TIFF images are unalterable. Or PDFs are unaltered. But it is sort of historically how we've gone about doing it, and it stayed around all these years. And you know, PDFs work, but there's a lot of baggage associated with those file types. Whereas a TIFF file is really small. So like you can have a TIFF file that's like 6 kilobytes.
So from a perspective, you can save money there by because I would assume that all this evidence needs to be preserved and maintained for a long, long time.
Some of it goes into the National Archives.
Absolutely. No, and I mean that makes a lot of sense that that size is an issue. I just would assume that there would be a way to process things faster.
Well, I mean, it So a single file is not particularly doesn't take particularly long to do, but when you have, you know, a million files to process, that can take time.
Yeah, absolutely. 100. How long, I don't know, how long would it take to process a million files?
Probably a couple weeks.
Okay.
It depends on the service that you use. Like I at DOJ, we had vendors who could process files. They had more beefy equipment than we did.
Right.
So in a pinch, we could go to them. We had a number of local labs within each of the buildings where attorneys could just drop off work product, or not work product, but discovery, and they would process it there locally. But if it was too big, we'd basically kick it out to the vendors.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I mean, you gotta use the right tool for the right job, but if you guys can do it internally, if you guys could do it internally, that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then
There's one other aspect of this too, which is that, and I refer to it as the velocity of the case. So, there are some cases that slowly plod along, and you can get to it as you get to it, and it's all fine and dandy. There are other cases that are like immediate and urgent, and that coupled with the volume of material will also dictate where the who processes what. If, I have half a terabyte of data and I've got 6 weeks to do it, that's great. If I've got a week, that's a completely different issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then in what do you see as one of the most as like the most historic milestone in application of AI for legal work so far?
Historic milestone. Well, I think the historically the biggest one, it was, I think, Cal and Tar. I think we're undergoing one right now, with generative AI, but I'm not sure that anybody's really hit on how to use generative AI properly. I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong. I haven't seen what everybody's got under their covers yet, but it's a difficult product to work with from a legal perspective.
Why is it so difficult to work with from a legal perspective?
So when we deal with discovery materials, and especially when producing to opposing counsel, whatever processes we do need to be repeatable and defensible. And that basically means that if I did it once, I can do it again exactly the same way and I will get exactly the same results. Generative AI, first of all, we don't know what it's doing. Like with Tar and Cal, we have a pretty good idea of what it's doing. Generative AI, we don't really know what it's doing. So if I went to generative AI and I said, find me all my privileged documents or find me all my responsive documents, I have fed information into that system. If I don't use the prompt properly, I will get erroneous results out of it, right? So, and there is a, at least in the legal community right now, I think there is a little bit of a fear about prompts and using it. The second thing is that if I ever put more documents into that LLM, I have now fundamentally changed the model's outcome for the first prompt that I put in. At least potentially. So what the only way to really fix that kind of problem is to store off snapshots as you go. And that will eat up a lot of space.
Absolutely.
And then on top of it, I've seen, so you can use it to do things like summarize documents, right? That's a lot of energy to waste on summarizing documents. And there are other potentially better ways of summarizing a document with other tools. But people are looking at it like it can do anything and everything, which most of these LLMs have a lot of capability behind them. But you really have to come back to that repeatable, defensible process, right? And I don't know if we're really quite there yet.
I'm inclined to agree with you. I mean, when you look at, I know you saw some of those cases from a couple of years ago where that attorney up in New York was using AI to write briefs, and then all the case law that it was referencing was made up, right? And I think he lost his license over it. But then I also know for a fact that, like, I'm sure you just saw everything that happened with Deloitte in Australia, where they used AI to generate some report for the Australian government. And again, a lot of the underlying basis for it was made up. I mean, you look at I know that the Secretary of HHS put out some report a couple of months ago, or maybe it was 6 months ago, and like half of it and all everything was referencing was completely made up. It's like nobody went in and checked everything,
Yeah.
and
So
it cracks me up.
there was another one more recently than the attorney that lost his license. There was an attorney who used a site that ChatGPT had found for him, and he verified that the case was at a real case, but he didn't check the actual citation in his motion. Turns out the citation was the exact opposite of what he was arguing. And I personally don't have any problem with people using ChatGPT to do this stuff, as long as they do their due diligence.
I'm with you, and I think that AI and I mean generative AI specifically, we're speaking about, and probably agentic AI is going to have a lot of uses within these fields, but in the legal space overall. But I agree with you that we're not there yet, for especially for like use cases that require re repeatability. Your point about how all the information that you put in changes your future outputs is fascinating. And it's something that I'm sure a lot of people don't think about as they use this, because now the AI ha the you know AI has an instance where it's no longer able to do. Like it'll reference back that information that you already put in, so you can't actually get the same result again, correct? How would
Yeah,
you?
it'll so, and I've given this quite a bit of thought recently, which is like, say I feed all my briefs, all my files for my case into an AI, and I could then, in theory, put all my documents that I'm have to review and say, okay, based on, what's been filed, what documents in my collection would be responsive. And you can do that. But the minute you put another filing in there, it's going to change the parameters. Right. So, or you have another production set that comes in at a large volume that can throw things off. It's also evolving so rapidly.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You mentioned agentic AIs. That's going to be an interesting space for a while. And I'm basically sort of sitting back and waiting for the dust to settle. Because, like, while I could go out and get a Llama LLM, and spin that up and run my database against that, it's going to be so outmoded in 8, 9 months. The tools are just they're evolving extremely rapidly. It seems like almost every 6 to 8 months we have something completely new built on top of it. So.
Yeah, and I expect that to c continue, right, at the pace that it is, potentially accelerate, especially as additional data gets put into it and we've solved some of these fundamental issues around it. Something I always like to remind people is like the AI that we're using today, it's the worst it's going to be for the rest of your life, right? Today.
Well,
It's just going to get better, right?
I was actually I read an article this morning about poisoning AIs, and some research just came out. I forget who did the study. That you can poison an AI, doesn't matter the so model size, with 250 documents.
That's incredible. By uploading 250 documents into it, you can get it to changes outputs.
What they
Like,
were testing, what they did was they put a code and then gibberish next to it on 250 documents. And just in the middle of a document, it would say this code, gibberish. And it with those 250 documents, they poisoned the whole thing. And basically what it did was it associated the code with gibberish.
Absolutely.
And that threw off the results.
Now, was this like a private model, or is this like,
I think it
Gemini?
was I think it was Anthropic that did it. But don't quote me on that.
Absolutely. No, and I find that also fascinating, and also how you, when you understand how these models like, ChatGPT, Gemini, value different data sources, right? An example I was given recently is that they put Reddit as one of their highest data sources because of all of the like user generated thoughtful information. But you can go in and manipulate all of that by like getting a whole bunch of bot accounts to upvote specific things and specific responses, and then that's going to throw off how they value certain parts of data. And that is, I mean, that's public, right? And if it's pretty easy to do there in though for those models, I really worry about when you start viewing things like, legal defense with it, or you start looking at intel, like in the intel space, or you're trying to make military decisions utilizing these tools or doing intel analysis, and then it's like, huh. Like, this is, how easy is it? If you and I know how to do this, like, what do these researchers at foreign adversaries know, right?
Well, there's so one other problem with this is that from a legal perspective, if you put material into an AI, it will always be there. And you can actually, there are ways of generating to get that content back out. And so if I'm the federal government, just as an example, and I use ChatGPT. And I throw a whole bunch of my documents as the federal government into ChatGPT. They now live in perpetuity in that model. That's a bunch of information that the federal government generally would not produce, right? And so, from a, if I was a private sector lawyer, I'd be very concerned about like you putting my documents into a cloud-based model, knowing that my client's documents are now stuck in that model. And in a lot of these cases, at the end of them, there's basically an order to say, okay, now that the case is settled, destroy all the information you have. And you no longer have that capability once it goes into like ChatGPT or any of
Even if
those.
it's a private, even if it's like an air-gapped instance in, say, deployed in a private cloud, it's still going to be there. Absolutely. You have to go and delete the whole
The whole
model
model.
and yeah.
And if I'm using one model for my whole for my attorney, legal team or whatever across multiple cases, you kind of just hosed yourself.
Absolutely. What are some of the attempts you've seen to use it to implement AI or automation in legal environments that just like haven't gone as planned?
So that's an interesting one. The federal government under Biden, we had a whole bunch of rules about generative AI that were like, thou shalt not touch it unless you meet all of these requirements. And then Trump came in and said, yeah, screw that. Sorry for my language.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm sorry. I'm sneezing over here. My allergies are getting me today. My apologies.
No, it's no problem. So as a result, DOJ didn't move aggressively with generative AI. They were right as I was leaving, there were some discussions. There was a large working group on AI in DOJ, but the actual implementations weren't really going full speed. I think the biggest one was there was a company called Recommind that we brought in 2000, as I think it was 2010, 11, that used tar, right? And they did a pilot with the antitrust division. And so antitrust has they have very fast turnaround times on their cases with large volumes of material. And so they needed to pilot it with one of their cases. And we found out that that product at that time had a, for technology assisted review, had an upper limit on the amount of documents that it could handle. And we hit that upper limit fairly quickly. And that whole pilot just basically failed.
Why did they have an upper limit? Were they throttling it, or is it it was just this, you broke it?
It was their architecture,
Oh,
really.
okay.
Like they hit physical limits on what they could handle in their core memory.
Absolutely. No, I totally understand. I know you have obviously, with all of the like innovative work you've done at DOJ over the years, I know you like, setting up the data science team, and others. What do you see as some of the next like radical changes, coming up within the litigation support space?
Well, I again go back to LLMs being a big game changer on the technical side. I'm not really entirely sure beyond that. I mean, I think 10, 15 years out, there'll be quantum computing, which will, I think, radically change just about everything, including litigation space. But I think right now, everybody's trying to figure out what to do with LLMs and coming up with a lot of different ideas, but what sticks is I'm not really sure. Because it's going back to the problems that we were talking about before with LLMs. But I think in the long, like 3 to 5 years, let's just say, I think LLMs will be. First, attorneys will be more comfortable with it because we saw the same. I'm seeing the same type of adaptation that I saw when CAL and TAR came out, which was there was this big hesitancy to use it. Nobody wanted to use it because they didn't know what they were doing, and it couldn't possibly be that good. And I did a lot of like walk going around to attorneys and. Did a lot of trainings just basically saying like this is better than what you can do. And no attorney wants to hear that something's better than them.
No kidding, man.
So those are fun. But the we're seeing the same adoption now. I mean they're prompt fears are real. People are just scared to try and use those tools. And I think what we'll see is more and more adoption of this type of technology. The major players in the industry are already spinning up their own models and this and that and the other. And but it's a lot of energy and horsepower and money
Absolutely.
to develop something that is that meets legal standards.
Absolutely. What are some of the largest challenges in lit support that you think could be tackled by some of these models?
So when I was at DOJ, I had this, and I would go and do trainings with the attorneys, talk to them about this. And I'd say, my goal here is to get to one attorney, one case. So you wouldn't need a team of attorneys to do a large case. And that was the philosophy that I held throughout most of my career in DOJ. We never really quite got there, But I think we will once LLMs have been fully integrated into the legal sphere, you'll have the ability to say, hey, here's all the documents. I think they did X, Y, and Z. Tell me if I'm right and find the documents that show me that I'm right. Right. And it'll and in natural language, you can have a conversation with your Chat GPT or what have you, your LLM. And it will become like a legal assistant, like a paralegal or, you know, your legal assistant. But sharper. The other thing about LLMs, and actually I didn't coin this, I was talking to somebody and he mentioned it, is that right now the LLMs are sort of like your first year law student or law school graduate. They know a lot, but are not really keyed into the nuances of things. So I think at some point somebody's going to start generating a legal-oriented LLM. I wouldn't be surprised if it came out of like a LexisNexis or somebody like that, who has access to a lot of material.
Absolutely. I'm sure that they're working on things like that now. So they right now they have a lot of enthusiasm, and they have a lot of knowledge, but they don't really know how to use that knowledge.
And it goes back to the site checking and things like that, where you can go ahead and use that, but you just need to do your due diligence.
Eventually, you think it will assist you with doing all of the due diligence and will understand the parameters around what it is, legally defensible and the point you're trying to defend and go out and find the exact right things. That's pretty cool.
But did you ever watch Blade Runner from the 80s? So when I was talking with at Legal Tech about what I wanted for the future, I said I want the there's a scene in there where Rutger, not Rutger Hauer, Ford was looking at a picture on a screen and he was saying track right, track down, and it was like zooming into the pictures. I said I want my legal tools to look to be like that, like from a modern perspective, but
Absolutely.
like where you can sort of intuitively have a conversation with the corpus of material that you have and get a better understanding of what it is that it is there and what you're trying to do with it.
Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure we do have a long way to go with a lot of these tools to make sure that we can, utilize them properly. I've been telling people for like a couple of years, I don't think we really know how to make money with AI yet. And I don't think it's really been monetized. It's like the 1990s, right? It's like the dot-com era boom of, but AI related. It's the AI boom from that perspective. There were no like there were no, ads weren't embedded in everything. There wasn't sponsored content. I'm just like wondering how long it's going to be before there's a sponsored answer and sponsored responses coming out of LLMs, right?
There's some of that going on. I mean, there's tens, hundreds of billions of dollars being thrown at this, at LLMs. There's a lot of talk about a bubble. I don't know if there's really going to be a bubble, but I mean, they are making some money off of it. It's just, I don't think they're making as much money as they're investing at this point.
Agree. Right now it's a loser still. Like Amazon started making money eventually, but the thing they started making money on is not what they started to do, right? Like we're selling books initially, and they were not a like there was no such thing as cloud hosted services, right? And they created that because they had all that extra server bandwidth, and that's what made them profitable. And that's the thing that continues to make money in spite of all of their, other ventures, whether it's the Washington Post or Whole Foods or the Amazon app or what, like Amazon buying like everything. AWS is what makes the most money. And they were down today. I don't know if you saw that.
I did.
It went down hard today. Everybody is, everybody will know when, this has been recorded because of that comment. So, hey. 100%, man. Like if you had a blank check to invest in any, like invest in the space, right? Would you be putting your money into finding ways to make LLMs useful within this space, and like truly, or would you be looking at a different advancement?
No, that's exactly what I'd be doing. Is trying to find the best use cases and the potentially trying to make a model that is specifically for litigation.
Absolutely.
With appropriate rags and guardrails and all that fun stuff.
Absolutely, man. No, 100%. Yeah, and having just retired from DOJ, can you tell us anything about what you're working on next or no?
I've got a couple irons in the fire. One, I'm looking at some potential application development, and that will be interesting. I've got quite a bit of it done, but we'll see.
Okay. All right, listen, I'm not trying to get your secrets out in the open. I'm just curious. Anything I missed, man? I think a pretty interesting conversation around litigation support, the challenges associated with prosecuting these massive cases. Any points we missed or anything that you'd like to highlight or say before we sign off today?
I will say this. So I have worked, and this is not a political message, but I have worked for every president since Bush Jr. And as a career civil service employee, that I never agreed with any president 100%. There
Absolutely.
was always something that I really disagreed with him about, but career civil servants, are some of the most apolitical people out there. There were a couple of cases right before I left DOJ that were really intense, and I really did not agree with them at all on the merits, but still went ahead and made sure that things were being taken care of. And yeah, I just want to give a shout out to all my former colleagues.
Absolutely. I know it's interesting times in our space. I have utmost respect for folks like yourself who've dedicated their lives to, serving the public and working for the public good. Civil servants, I agree, are, I think that there's a perception that many folks don't work very hard in the government, and I'm sure that there's some that don't, but I know that there's a whole lot of people that are highly dedicated and really, 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 are deserving of our respect and appreciation and gratitude. So thank you, man. I really appreciate all you've done to help us become better in prosecuting cases for DOJ.
Yeah, I will add one more thing. So I was fortunate in my career to get where I was, and then also I worked with just about every federal agency at some point in my career. I, with the exception of a couple people, I have never seen a more dedicated workforce.
Absolutely.
That's
Yeah.
all.
Awesome. Really appreciate it, Josh. And love all the civil servants out there. Really appreciate your time today. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to Robots and Red Tape, and I hope you're having a wonderful day.